I think the reason that my case has gotten so much attention is both because I'm tenured and because I'm Jewish. You know, I don't really think it's about me and I don't really think it's about the student. I think it's about this larger landscape of repression in the United States.
As a Jewish person, Maura, how does that make you feel?
I think academic freedom is a fantasy.
A fantasy.
While it is going to be loud and violent, Zionism is losing.
About a year ago, in January 2024, Jewish American academic Maura Finkelstein found herself placed on administrative leave by her institution at the time, Muhlenberg College. A few months later, she was fired, despite the fact that she had tenure. And the reason behind all this was that she shared a post on her Instagram story which heavily condemned Zionism in light of Israel's war in Gaza, now widely labeled a genocide. So, we're speaking to Maura to reflect not only on this experience and her next steps, but also about what this taught her about free speech on U.S. campuses. And she joins us now from New York, Maura Finkelstein. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
No, I'm so glad to have you. There's a lot that we're going to go through. But you know what? I do want to say I interviewed Dr. Roz Segal the other day, and he mentioned you. And I was like, oh, perfect. I know who my next guest is. Yeah, I'm going to reach out
to
him.
Yeah, Roz is great.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm excited to listen to that.
And also, just to clarify this on the record, because I've spoken to a few people and they're like, oh, great, you're going to speak to Norman's daughter. There is no relation. There is no,
There's
we
no
need
relation.
To set the record straight.
It's really funny because I mean, we've now met, but up until recently, we had never met. I was familiar with his work. And, you know, that was sort of the extent of it. But last year, some of my like haters on the internet started referring to me as a Nepo baby. And I was like, what?
A Nepo baby.
And then I realized that I get mistaken for his daughter or his niece, and we are of no relation, but I think part of a larger family of anti-Zionist Jews. So I'll claim that.
Well, I'm glad we set the record. More, look, I like I said, there's a lot to get through, but I do want to kind of do a quick refresher for our audience and viewers kind of tuning in. So in, let's say what, it was late 2023, there was an investigation that was conducted against you by the university that you worked in. And it's called Muhlenberg College. And I guess it was kickstarted by the fact that a student complained about your social media activity. Can we just do like a quick refresher about what happened?
Yeah, so the timeline is a little off. So what happened to me is what happened to a lot of faculty, staff, students across the US, around the world, in Canada, throughout Europe, after October 7th, 2023, after Al-Aqsa fled. Those of us who, and you know, this of course most negatively impacts Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim faculty, staff, and students on university campuses, but those of us who were already involved in Palestine liberation work, I taught about Palestine. I had already taught about Palestine in September of 2023. Those of us who had already been doing this work sort of immediately after October 7th, got on the radar of our administrations because there was so much Zionist pressure to silence all support of Palestinian liberation and criticism of the Zionist entity, as we are often calling it. And so in mid-October 2023, a student in two of my classes filed a complaint against my teaching because I had contextualized October 7th within a larger, you know, century of settler colonial genocide in Palestine. And
you were basically
so
saying that
was,
it didn't start on October 7th, like there is history to this.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
The sort of like basement of history, right? Like this is like very low stakes. And, you know, I think, you know, for those of us who were already teaching about Palestine, the knots that we were twisting ourselves into already in order to not alienate Zionist students, many of us are very well trained in how to manage the sort of heat that we receive for teaching about Palestine. And so, you know, it was very, It was very surprising, actually, to have this complaint because I had been doing this work for over a decade. But a complaint was filed on about my teaching that I was creating a hostile environment in the classroom, and the college sort of informally investigated me. They didn't really find grounds for the complaint. The student dropped the complaint. Then there was in late October, there was a great concern over something I published called Never Again Means Never Again for Anyone, in which I made what I thought was a sort of easy argument that nobody should experience genocide, and that that my college administration was very concerned about me publishing my opinion, and perhaps in the words of Zionist students who were upset that I was a Holocaust denier because I claimed that there were multiple genocides that have happened throughout history. So that was an investigation. And then students at Hillel International, and for your listeners who don't know about Hillel International, Hillel brands themselves, and they used to be the Center for Jewish Life on college and university campuses, but they are actually a Zionist organization.
Yeah, they're the biggest Jewish campus organization in the world.
Yes.
And yeah, like I think over the last decade or maybe more, they've been accused of being a lot more Zionist and a lot less tolerant of anti-Israel views.
Yeah, and just to sort of contextualize it without giving too much history, they were founded in 1923, and from 1923 until 1980, they really were the Center for Jewish Life on college campuses. There were these sort of autonomous Hillels on mostly US and Canadian campuses, but I think around the world. And in 1980, when we have this neoliberal turn, what you see with Hillel is that they become centralized, it becomes Hillel International. It's a large organization that has millions of dollars coming in from Zionist donors who start building Hillel International in partnership with Israel and the sort of Hasbara network of making Israel at the center of Hillel's work. They're very explicit about this. It's on their website. This isn't a secret. They have Hasbara fellowships where they send Jewish, American, Canadian, British students to Israel to be trained in Israeli Hasbara. They have birthright trips. They have all. They have Israel fellows on campus, which are former Israeli soldiers who are helping Jewish, American, Canadian, et cetera, students forge a relationship with Israel, move to Israel, join the Israeli army. So they're doing very active Zionist work. And at Muhlenberg College, where I worked, Hillel is very powerful. And so in no starting in November 2023 through December and into January, Hillel students started filing complaints based on my social media, none of which became anything formal until January, when I reposted a slide written by the Palestinian poet Remy Kanazi. And I was accused of basically violating Title VI of the US civil rights law. Title VI is really being weaponized to shut down any support of Palestine by claiming that Zionist, a political ideology, is actually a protected class like religion or nationality. And so a student at Hillel, and because of the leadership at Hillel, they sort of encouraged the student to file a complaint, sent the student screenshots of my social media. The student filed a complaint. The college it had an in outside investigative firm spend months and who knows how much money investigating me. The investigation actually found that I did not violate any policies. I was just,
But then the university overturned it.
but then. Then the university overturned it and fired me on May 30th, 2024. And I've been in a series of appeals ever since. But yeah, I mean, I got a letter on May 30th saying your last day is tomorrow. Your benefits will, be cut off tomorrow. Clear your office out. Return your
So no
computer to
severance.
HR. No severance. Yeah, it was
Wow.
it, what I did. My reposting of the slide was so egregious.
And to
That,
be clear,
it was
Maura, sorry to
nothing.
cut you off. The
No,
post or
please.
the tweet was like you said, Remy Kanazi, and he was condemning Zionism basically in that tweet.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I support his words 100%. I would post that post again. I do not like, I'm not backing down on it at all, but it is quite offensive for a, I consider myself to be a writer. And if I'm going to be fired for something, I want it to be something that I actually said. I say a lot of things, but the argument that the college made was that I shouldn't, but I can get away with critiquing Zionism, but the post says Zionist, and that was their sort of linguistic trick of you can't say anything bad about Zionists because we have students who identify as Zionists, and therefore you're denying them access to an education because you're making them feel unsafe, which is code for uncomfortable.
And as an academic, someone who, is the use of language is integral to their, everyday profession. What did that mean to you?
I've been thinking a lot about this, obviously, over the past year. And, I am a writer, I'm a teacher, I'm an academic. I think language matters. I think the words that we mean, that we use matter. And I also follow someone like Muhammad Al-Kurd, who's argued this many times, who writes about this in the new book. I don't actually care about language right now. What I care about is the fact that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been brutally murdered in a genocide, and tens of thousands are, missing under the rubble. People are starving to death, freezing to death. The Zionist entity is continuing genocide, continuing ethnic cleansing in the occupied West Bank. We have actual physical, material violence happening in Palestine. And so, if I use a word that makes a student in the United States who's probably totally fine materially, physically, if I use a word that makes them feel uncomfortable, the idea that that is more important than the, tens of thousands of college and university students who are dead or can't go to school because of Scholasticide in Gaza. I just, the fact that we're sort of like wrapped up in this idea of language being violence and actual physical material violence being co inconsequential actually makes me feel crazy.
There's a couple things that I want to just kind of delve into from everything you've said. Basically, that complaint, the one that was related to your social media, you've never met that student, correct?
I've never met that student. That student has never tried to take a class with me, as far as I know. When I saw the report and saw the student's name, I recognized the student's name because this was somebody who had been watching all of my Instagram stories, sort of surveilling me on social media for months. But we have never met. And, I'm sure that we will never cross paths. And I'm sure that student had no intention of taking my classes. And I'm pretty confident that that student doesn't actually care about, the impact that my words have on them personally. I think it's more about being part of a movement that is actively trying to hold on to the power that Zionism has in the United States, which means that anyone speaking out on behalf of Palestinian liberation is a great threat. So, I don't really think it's about me, and I don't really think it's about the student. I think it's about this larger landscape of repression in the United States. And if this student and the Zionist movement thought that they were actually just and right, they wouldn't be so scared of what people like me are saying. But actually, the optics of the past year and a half have been pretty bad. And I think this is evidence that while it is going to be loud and violent, Zionism is losing.
But how did you, so if you've never met this student, how did you know that there was a link to Hillel International?
Oh, this student is in leadership at Hillel, both
Oh,
on the
okay.
campus, both on the campus level and on the international organization level. This student is very proud of their involvement, and so a little Google search gave me a lot of information.
And would Hillel basically, or Hillel, I'm not sure how to pronounce it correctly, but would Hillel kind of influence a student's decision to target you?
Oh yeah, I mean, what I learned through the investigation into me is that the director of Hillel and the Israel Fellow, so this former Israeli soldier who had a fellowship on Muhlenberg's campus in order to help students move to Israel and join the Israeli military, is that they had a WhatsApp group chat with Hillel students. And on a regular basis, these two adult staff members were taking screenshots of my social media, sending them to students on this group chat and encouraging students to file complaints against me. It is quite possible that the students themselves were following me. I have public accounts and doing this work themselves, but it was actually the adults who were both saying that my social media was a form of violence, that students were seeing it and it was a form of violence, but they were the ones who were also sending images of my posts to students and saying, do something about this. You can file a report. You can file a complaint through the Equal Opportunity Non-Discrimination Policy held by at small colleges like Muhlenberg. It's through our Title IX office. So this is coming from Hillel leadership.
Let me ask you this more. So you've been at Muhlenberg for 9 years, right? You taught for 9 years. And you've said this before. I heard you say this quote. You said that I've always had an ethical practice of making sure that I include Palestine in my teaching. So, this kind of rhetoric is not new to you, and anybody that's taken your class would have known. So what was different this time around, or did you have similar scenarios in previous years with other students?
So before October 7th, 2023, before Al-Aqsa flood, I never had any complaints about my teaching or my publication or my social media ever. I found out that Hillel students had an unofficial boycott of my classes, which is
Oh,
unfortunate,
a
but
boycott.
so I had a lot of students over the years, Jewish students, who told me that they wanted to take classes with me, but they also wanted to have a social world on campus. And they were told by students at Hillel that, to stay away from my classes, and that if they were to take my classes, they would feel like they couldn't, go to Shabbat dinner at Hillel. They couldn't, be around the community that they cultivated at Hillel. So I found out through closeted anti-Zionist Jewish students at Muhlenberg over the years that they were constantly encouraged by Hillel leadership students not to take my classes. But on the level of the administration, I never really had any problem. And I think that that was in large part because I am Jewish. A lot of colleagues of mine who are Palestinian, who are Arab, who are Muslim, have experienced this kind of surveillance and this kind of harassment throughout their entire careers. And I had the privilege of not of being on a college campus that didn't seem all that combative. I mean, it's very Zionist, but the biggest thing that students would do is just not take my classes. And I think what we've seen over the past year and a half is that Zionists have been emboldened in the US and Canada and Europe to use these tactics that they've been developing over the past few decades to shut down support of Palestinian liberation. They've taken them to these institutions, and we're seeing just across the country, college and universities. And this was all under a Biden administration. So this is even before Trump took office. You just see these constant crackdowns on speech, on teaching, on publications. You see, staff being fired, adjuncts being fired, students being suspended. I think the reason that my case has gotten so much attention is both because I'm tenured and because I'm Jewish, but I am not, I am amongst a large community of faculty, staff, and students whose institutions are finding ways to quiet them, control them, surveil them, harass them, threaten them, fire them, suspend them. I mean, we just saw two students at Barnard College be suspended. This is a major, major crisis. And the Trump administration is just allowing for these crackdowns to be louder, but they've been here all along.
You mentioned And you're right, you did get a lot of attention because of the fact that you were tenured. And it's such a, you know, it's a sought after title for really any academic working in higher ed. But just to briefly explain what it means for an academic to be tenured.
If you do manage to get one of these very, very, very few, rare, difficult to get tenure track jobs, you are hired at the level of an assistant professor. And for the next 6 years, you're sort of proving to your institution and your department and your supervisors that you can teach in the way that the institution wants you to teach. You can be productive in terms of publication or research in the way that the institution wants you to be productive. And you can participate in, you know, we call it service, but the sort of like larger sort of social life of the college, which is, you know, serving on committees, being part of faculty governance, et cetera, et cetera. And if you then get tenure, you're promoted to the level of associate professor with tenure. And that means that, you know, historically, you are no longer vulnerable to, for example, a conservative administration that does not like your progressive research, or a difficult department chair who doesn't like the post-colonial view you bring to your teaching. You know, it's really supposed to protect faculty so that they can do work that might be contrary to the logics of an institution, which is usually very conservative. So the idea is that it protects academic freedom. Whether or not that's true or not is another question. But because of this, it should be very, very, very hard to fire a tenured professor. In fact, we have, you know, all of these sort of norms within what's often called a faculty handbook about what needs to be done in order to make that happen. And it's almost impossible to do, which is why we hear stories all the time about, they just often happen to be, but not always, white heterosexual male professors who harass their junior colleagues, who harass students. We hear about sexual assault, we hear about racism, we hear about all of these things that professors can get away with because it is so hard to get rid of faculty once they have tenure. And that is the dark side of it. And so what happened with my case, and what I think we're going to see more and more, is that college and university administrations are eroding the norms of faculty governance, the way it's supposed to go in order to remove tenured faculty from the classroom and from campus. And they're creating these sort of special administrative black boxes where, particularly in terms of Palestine, faculty who are seen as a threat by the institution can be lifted out of the norms of faculty governance and adjudicated simply by the administration. And I think that that's incredibly dangerous, but it also reveals the ways in which the system as it is incredibly broken and has been for a really long time.
And when the Intercept story broke, which kind of, you know, brought shine a spotlight on your story, did that change things for you in any way, even in terms of how people were speaking to you and people around you?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I haven't had that many colleagues of mine reach out to me, aside from the small handful of people that I had a relationship with. But I have heard, and I've seen this in the student paper, that when the Intercept story broke, the faculty became very, very upset because the college kept saying, trust us, she did something terrible. And then the story broke, and the faculty's response on a collective level was, you told us she did something terrible. It seems like maybe that's not true. We need transparency here. So I think that the Intercept story coming out, I think the way that we're seeing this like neo-McCarthyism, if you want to call it that, spreading throughout the United States and out into Canada, we're seeing this in Europe as well. At least on my campus, it definitely made people question the administration in ways that they maybe hadn't before, which is curious to me because, I mean, I'm a person who never trusts power, but I think most of my colleagues wanted to trust that the administration was doing their due diligence and that I must have done something pretty terrible to be removed from campus. And of course, that's not true.
When you say that only a small handful of colleagues have reached out, I mean, how did that make you feel that maybe not a bigger number had reached out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are scared. I think that people probably don't know what to say. I think, my story has gotten a lot of attention, but I don't, I've had the great luck to visit a lot of different campuses around the country this year. And everywhere I go, faculty, staff, and students are dealing with a different kind of administrative monster, but they're all dealing with an administrative monster. I haven't met anyone who feels comfortable and safe in their jobs. I haven't met anyone who feels like everything's okay. I mean, we can just look around and see that everything is not okay. And I think the attitude of a lot of people is just like, keep your head down, keep doing what you are doing. It's a really, really scary time. I think people see what happened to me, and instead of that, at least on my campus, instead of that being, this reminder that we are all vulnerable, I think that sometimes my story can be a reminder that if you draw too much attention to yourself, you're going to get fired. But I do think, I will say, well, it hasn't entirely, aside from trusted colleagues who I appreciate and respect so much at Muhlenberg, well, I don't really actually know what's happening on the campus. What I do know is that over the past year and a half, I have created relationships with faculty all over the country and around the world who are also doing the work of what, Bodhi Judah has called multiple times just like basic dignity, like decency. Like, I don't think any of us are doing anything other than, thinking about what we have to lose, what we're willing to lose, and, taking risks because there is a genocide happening and because, there's crackdowns even more so than before on undocumented people in this country, on trans. We're seeing these like horrific fascist attacks on so many different communities. We're seeing genocide. We're seeing this horrible violence. What is the basic decency of being a person right now? I think, I've had the great luck of connecting with so many people who are working so hard to sort of fight back against this violent fascist turn that we're seeing on a global level. And so, even if that's not happening directly between me and my colleagues at the campus where I was working, it is happening on a more global scale, and that has felt very powerful.
And what about the students? I mean, surely over the past 9 years, you've fostered, various relationships with students. Has this affected them in any way? Do you know?
Yeah, over the past year, and again, I can only be in contact with the students who reach out to me on social media because I was, as you know, since January 2024, I haven't had access to my work email. But students are organizing on campus. The student newspaper has been very, very vocal about, pushing back against the sort of liberal civility of the campus as it's been historically. Students are, I think, and we're seeing this across the country and around the world. I can't speak directly to how this is playing out on Muhlenberg's campus because I'm not there, but I do think that our students are showing us the best versions of what education can be, what solidarity can be, what risk can be, how you show up no matter what you're facing. I think not just the student encampments, although those have been incredible, but also just the ways that students continue to fight for divestment. They continue to, rally around their comrades who are being arrested and doxxed and expelled and suspended. The student movement is quite powerful.
We're going to take a step back and look at things, like I said, from a wider lens. But I do want to ask you, you said you've received threats because of this at the time. I mean, did you ever fear for your life or for your safety?
I think you can't receive, the internet has just, and social media has really changed the way that we interact with each other. I think people feel very emboldened to say the most horrific things through email, through direct messages on social media, just in general. And I have had absolutely horrific things said to me on a regular basis, which 90% of the time I can remember that this is just a coward on the internet who is trying to, create a reaction in me. It's not about me. I don't know who this person is. I don't know where they are. Hopefully they don't know where I am. And so it's a distraction. I think every once in a while I had one person DM me that they had pictures of me walking my dog, which they did not have. In fact, it became this whole
They sent you the
chat.
picture. Like the chat was
No,
just the
no, no. They
picture. Oh.
just said, "I have pictures of you walking your dog." And I was like, "Send me the picture." And they were sort of saying all of these things that made me think that they knew where I was. And they were like, "Well, actually, I can't get this picture to go through, but I do also have this picture of your father. I'll just send this to you." And then they sent me a picture of Hitler. And that was actually like quite funny because I realized that this was just a troll on the internet who
Right.
was, trying to get her eyes out of me. It was a good lesson in not how not to react. I think, I get lots of threats, and so far they have not been anything other than, words thrown at me that have very little impact on me because I have never done anything that I question, and I know that I'm on the, side of justice and liberation, so I really don't care what a Zionist thinks. I think what is hard is that most of the violent words, if we're going to let words be violent, that come at me are from other people who are identifying as Jewish and who are Zionist, and the things that they want to have happen to me are so horrific. And of course, these are also people who are actively supporting the real violence of genocide against Palestinians. And I think it's just part of the larger landscape of, what Zionism as a settler colonial genocidal ideology is. And so in large part, it's a terrible reminder, but it's a nice reminder that like this is actually what Zionism is. There is nothing about Zionism that can be redeemed. But I do think that it's hard to see that the hatred that Jewish Zionists have towards me and the things that they fantasize about happening to me.
And
It's
as a Jewish person, Maura, how does that make you feel?
That's a hard question because I think, my relationship to Zion to Ju Judaism has always been complicated because of Judaism's relationship to Zionism. And I think it's quite hard, if not impossible, to disentangle that. I can say all the time that I'm an anti-Zionist Jew. But I do think that Judaism over the past, I would make up a number, but I would say, last 50 years in the United States, it seems to be that Judaism ha in America has replaced God with Israel, and Israel is at the center of what it means to be Jewish right now. And so for me, my relationship with Judaism feels quite marginal. I think, the thing that feels the most important is to do absolutely everything I can to fight for the dismantling of Zionism and the end of the Zionist entity, because I don't think that there is really a way to be Jewish right now that is not centering that work. And so that, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but in some ways I kind of don't care, or I can't spend a lot of time thinking about how it feels to, think about my relationship with Judaism right now, because I think that's a sort of secondary question until Palestine is free.
You say you're an anti-Zionist Jew. People who share similar stances to yours and who are also Jewish are becoming, they're basically going on the radar of political figures in the country. Like just the other day, Steve Bannon said, American Jews who don't support Israel are MAGA's main enemy.
The number one enemy to the people in Israel are American Jews that do not support Israel and do not support MAGA.
This is not a new phenomenon. It's been here. It's just I think getting a lot more attention right now, and you have these very, very vocal Jewish Zionist organizations showing us exactly who they are, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL. They've always been a conservative and violent organization who has shut down the civil rights movement. They've been fighting against, or not shut down the civil rights, but they've been fighting to shut down civil rights movements, farm workers, unions, you know, Palestine liberate, like they've always been on the wrong side of history. We're seeing this organization, Mothers Against Campus Anti-Semitism, that are actively trying to, you know, get faculty fired, who are, you know, putting pressure on administrators. We're seeing Betar US, this like very, very, very conservative Zionist organization that is even seen like, you know, Hillel and the ADL and people like Shai Davidi as not radical enough. They're much louder than they've ever been. But what I think Jewish Zionists don't understand is that they are far outnumbered by Christian nationalists, by Christian Zionists, whose Right. big project is actually about supporting Jewish Zionists in order to work towards the protection of the state of Israel, the Zionist entity, the destruction of Palestine, in order for the second coming to happen, in which case all Jews will either be killed or they'll convert to Christianity. And, you know, it's a very concerning movement to see, you know, Jewish Zionists partnering with Christian Zionists in, you know, I think both groups think that they're using the other, but Jewish Zionists are very outnumbered. So of course it makes sense that someone like Steve Bannon, other Christian nationalists and Christian Zionists, the far right, people like Trump, I mean, they're going to put people like me as the enemy, because of course we are, right? We're not complicit with the sort of expansion of this settler colonial violence. And we're going to continue to call that out. That's very, very dangerous to those who are in power. So that makes sense. And, you know, if fighting for the liberation of everyone is, you know, something that puts me as like an enemy of the state, then I'm happy to take that position. That seems like the right place to stand with my comrades who are also in this fight and teaching me how to be in this fight.
And how would you use your case to, you know, your story, your experience, to really explain the context of academic freedoms on U.S. campuses today?
Yeah, I mean, I will preface that by saying I think academic freedom is a fantasy.
A fantasy.
It's a fantasy in a country that is, you know, the country and all of its institutions are built on stolen land with the, you know, labor of enslaved people, and colleges and universities have been complicit in that project from the beginning. So if you take these wildly colonialist, violent institutions and you just like let more people in, which is what has been happening over the past few decades, you don't change the fact that these are wildly unequal hierarchical institutions. And so the idea of academic freedom, I always say, like, academic freedom for who? Who actually has academic freedom? And, you know, what does that actually mean? We're talking about very hierarchical institutions. But I think the sort of last gasp of this sort of norm of academic freedom that we see things like tenure protecting, I think that if we want to sort of hold on to the shadow of what it means to work in a college or university where you have somewhat some sense of protection in order to do the critical work that a lot of people are doing, not everybody, but a lot of people are doing, then I think we have to fight really, 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 really hard against the wave that we're seeing throughout colleges and universities that are really allowing administrators the power to determine who can and cannot be on our campuses. And that is about students being suspended, students being expelled, staff being fired, professors being put on leave, all of these things that are happening not within the sort of larger collective faculty governance, you know, model, which is not perfect, but it's better than just the sort of top-down college president or provost or dean determining what is going to happen based on people's actions. I think we have to first protect faculty governance and push back against this wave of repression. And, you know, this is existing within new, you know, executive orders and demands from the Trump administration that are, you know, going after DEI initiatives, equity initiatives, anything that is about teaching or doing work around anti-colonial movements, around gender, around LGBTQ issues. You know, we're seeing this like attack on equity initiatives sort of across the colleges and universities in the United States. And, you know, what are we going to do now? Are we going to resist these threats, or are we going to sort of roll over and let our colleges and universities basically just become corporate entities of the state? I'm very concerned about the latter being our future.
But even hearing you speak, Maura, did what happened to you shock you, or was it, did it come at no surprise?
Both.
Both.
I think
it shocked you, and it didn't shock you.
I think that you know, the fall semester was just a sort of overwhelming sense of, can this really be happening? Is this really where we're at right now? I think by January, when I was placed on leave, it sort of occurred to me that because the administration was placed in such a difficult spot because of their donors and because of who their students and alumni are, I realized that, you know, if they're going to choose between alienating their financial base or alienating their faculty, my college had shown over and over and over again that they didn't mind alienating the faculty. They've been doing it for years. And so I sort of knew by the time I was put on leave in January that eventually I would be fired. I was fighting against it, but I sort of thought that that was the inevitable conclusion. I think what's scary about my case is that if this is the direction that we are moving, then no one, and we're seeing this now, I mean, it's coming to fruition, no one working in college and universities, no one working at any institution is safe, because what we're seeing is that leadership is not willing to take a stand as we find fascists who are threatening the future of our institutions. I think, you know, I might have been fired because Palestine is such a dangerous thing to hold on to in the academy, but this is not going to end here. And I think anyone who is doing work that, you know, challenges power in any way is going to become vulnerable because of the complicity of our college and university leaders with, you know, this very, very conservative government that we have had in the United States for a very long time.
On that specific note, let me read you a quote from the essay you mentioned earlier in our chat. I think it's Never Forget. So this was in October 23. You said the United States in Europe will never have to truly confront their own anti-Semitism as long as Israel is held up and celebrated as the one place Jews can feel safe. This safety is a mirage, and this trauma is binding. It allows us to center our own pain while blindly participating in the ongoing genocide of Palestinian people. Never Forget has become a chant of complicity. Now, why do you feel the need to write these words?
I have heard my whole life that the only reason or the only way that Jews in the world can be safe is because of the state of Israel, which is a completely ridiculous statement to make. I think instead it means that countries like the United States, countries like Germany, can hold on to their anti-Semitism. They can actually center it. And they can say, if you don't feel safe here, you can always go to Israel and you can be safe there. I think it really like lets Western countries off the hook and makes all Jewish people unsafe. Because the idea is, you know, Joe Biden, when he was still president, saying the only reason, you know, Jews are safe is because of Israel, means that, you know, he did not feel like he has to do anything to make Jewish people safe in the United States. That's a very concerning statement. But I think more than that, because I'm not, you know, I think anti-Semitism is a real thing, but I think my biggest concern right now is where I'm actually seeing violence, and it's against Palestinian Arab Muslim folks, people of color. The perceived safety and the real safety, these things are quite different. I think that the reason that countries like the United States and Germany hold on so tightly to preserving the state of Israel is because of what the state of Israel allows for imperial powers to be. So the United States is a settler colonial state built on stolen land. And so, of course, the United States will do everything to protect the state of Israel, which is also a settler colonial state built on stolen land with an apartheid system that is devastating. There's no version of peace or freedom in the region as long as Israel still exists. And I think for the United States, the fear is that not only would Israel collapse, but the collapse of Israel, which I think is inevitable, and the end of Zionism, which I think is inevitable, will demand or shine a light on the violence of the United States as a settler colonial state. And so the hope is that the structure that is Israel will collapse and it will bring the United States down with it. So I think I wrote that essay because I truly believe that, nobody is free or safe as long as these violent states continue to exist. And so I have been raised in the United States under this fantasy of never again, never again, the Holocaust, the Holocaust, the Holocaust, the Holocaust. But to then carry out a genocide because of the Holocaust in my name with my tax dollars, I mean, how do we live with that? It's absolutely horrific. And I think that, we have so much to reckon with in the United States, in Israel, in Germany, and we're not reckoning with our history. We're actually, building fascist structures that make it illegal to reckon with our history. And that just is going to perpetuate violence. And that's exactly what it's doing.
I'm curious. I mean, how did you come to these conclusions? Or, I heard you say that you've been an anti-Zionist since you were 16. So how did you, I guess, unlearn, if you will, and come to the conclusion that you're basically, the stance that you have today?
Yeah, I mean, I have the great luck of never really having to unlearn Zionism. My parents are not Zionists. I was raised within a Jewish community, and I went to a synagogue and went to Hebrew school within a Zionist framework. And so I was exposed to that, but it wasn't something that I felt pushed upon me, in my family of origin. What my early education, so before I was a teenager, was just that there's this country on the other side of the world, and that's sort of like where your heritage is, and it's beautiful and wonderful, and maybe you'll go there someday, and like let's learn Israeli folk songs, et cetera, et cetera. But there was no mention of Palestine or Palestinians. And so as a teenager, when I realized that that was a lie, because I started reading Palestinian writers and learning a perspective about the region that was completely contrary to, what I had been raised with, it sort of, collapsed the myth that was circulating throughout my childhood about this idyllic, country on the other side of the world that I felt no connection to. And I think that that really started me down a path of questioning how I'm being taught history, how I'm being told about the world, like whose perspective am I actually getting? Because actually reading Palestinian writers writing about the region makes a
Right, you
whole
mentioned
lot
Edward
more
Said at one
sense.
point.
Yeah.
Yeah, Question
I
of
mean,
Palestine.
when I read that book for the first time when I was 16, and I mean, I don't even now, years later, it's a very, very hard text to read, I think. I
It's
definitely didn't.
difficult. It's not easy. Yeah.
And I definitely did not understand most of it when I was a teenager, but I think just realizing that there was a whole different way of telling the story that was sort of mythologized in my Jewish community, and that the fact that my Jewish community felt like the only way they could tell this, their story of Israel was by either demonizing Palestinians or erasing them completely. And that made me deeply distrust and, reject the Jewish version of the region that I was given as a child. And, I think that if you live in a settler colony and you're willing to actually, like in the United States, read native writers and think about native history, it should be no surprise that the exact same thing with the different structures is happening in a place like Palestine. And so, I see a lot of Jewish Zionists leaving Zionism or breaking up with Zionism or having a revelation about the things that they accepted or believed or whatnot. And I think that that doesn't make all that much sense to me just because of the way that I like sought out Palestinian perspectives and Palestinian voices and Palestinian views because of my feeling of being unsettled by the settler narrative. But I do like extend empathy that it must be very hard to realize that you've been lied to your whole life. But I think that that's why we need to fight so hard to protect our spaces of education where we are being taught how to unlearn the lies that we are given as young people. I mean, that's what happened to me in high school, and that's what I tried to do as a college professor, and that's why education can be so dangerous.
And, we're a couple months away from approaching the 1 year anniversary of the campus protests in the U.S. That were pro-Gaza or in solidarity with Gaza. But we've also seen steps that were very much could be seen as a backlash to the protests. And a few examples is when NYU changed its guidelines around hate speech and harassment to include the criticism of Zionism as a discriminatory act. And then recently, Harvard adopted the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which is a very controversial definition. But ostensibly, they both seem aimed to what happened on U.S. campuses a year ago. But how are you reacting to this backlash?
It's really scary. I mean, I think that, a place like Muhlenberg College has not, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but as far as I know, Muhlenberg has not adopted the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which, has, I think, 11 examples of what can be anti-Semitism, and six of those examples, so that's more than half, are about actually Zionism and Israel, criticizing Zionism and Israel. But I think anywhere we're seeing the work of, institutions collapsing, anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism or linking being Jewish with being a Zionist, we should first of all be very concerned. But also, I think that that's buying into the IHRA definition. I think that that's really buying into Zionist work of shutting down any, speech and action on behalf of Palestinian liberation, which, frames an anti-Zionist Jew like myself as anti-Semitic, but it also frames or like renders Palestinians as inherently anti-Semitic because they are fighting against the, colonial force that is genociding them. So I think that that's very scary. But I do think, my case shows how that was happening before the encampments began, or before they sort of like gathered steam, because Columbia University does get the attention of sort of being the first and the most important. But I think that Stanford might have been the first encampment months before that. It was just a much quieter. But I do think that the backlash makes sense because what the encampments were revealing was the, way that young people are saying we are no longer willing to comply with empire, not only because we are seeing how a genocide is being carried out in Palestine with our tax dollars and in our name, but I think, what the encampments really showed, and the Columbia encampment showed this, the University of Chicago encampment showed this, the UCLA encampment showed this, is that students are making connections. They're seeing the way that the violence of the United States and Israel in Palestine is directly linked to the way in which we're seeing violence carried out in this country now. We're seeing this through the treatment of unhoused people. We're seeing it through gentrification. We're seeing it through all, the fact that we have concentration camps at the border and the way that we treat undocumented people. Students were making those connections, and that is so dangerous for those who are in power, whether it be university administrators or our politicians, which I think is why we had these congressional hearings over how university presidents were going to shut this down. I think we're going to continue to see this backlash, but I also think that we're going to continue to see resistance. And I think especially in the wake of the Trump administration, in which so many policies that are carried out under Democratic administrations, but quietly, civilly, and with a smile, are now, just sort of loud and brash under a Trump administration. I think that we're going to see a lot more violence, and young people are not willing to put up with that. I mean, I think that, the encampments showed that our young people understand how all of these different forms of violence and injustice are deeply entwined, and that nobody is free until everybody is free. And until there's a liberated Palestine, there's no hope for the rest of us, which doesn't mean that Palestine has any, responsibility to do anything other than, Palestinians have the responsibility to fight for their lives and their communities. They're not, who cares what's happening in the United States? But I think students are seeing the connections between liberation movements across the world, across history. They want to learn. And of course, that is incredibly dangerous. So I think we're going to continue to see backlash. I think there is a lot of violence that's to come. And, everywhere I've had the opportunity to travel this past year to talk to students, faculty, and staff, people are very scared. And also, I don't know anybody who personally who wants to return to the status quo, because we've been living in a very violent status quo for a very, very long time. And anyone who thinks that they can continue to be okay amidst this very violent status quo probably has a harsh reality coming to them.
More, I'm gonna close with this, although I do want to keep the conversation going, but I also don't want you to miss your flight.
I appreciate that.
What are your next steps? I mean, what do you hope to achieve next? I mean, are you hoping to get reinstated? Are you still appealing? What's happening right now with everything that's already gone down?
Yeah, so I am in the midst of an appeal, and so I can't talk about it yet. I think, the thing that I have wanted for some time now is just the opportunity to make a decision for myself, and we'll see if that becomes possible. But I think, it's a very, very, very scary time to, exist, but it's a very, very scary time to work at a college or university right now in the United States, because I think the Trump administration and our university and college administrators are accelerating work that's been happening for decades. This isn't new, but it's, the classroom should be a space in which students and teachers can learn together and ask hard questions and think, expansive thoughts about the future and the world and ideas and whatnot. And that's being attacked and criminalized right now. And so I think that there's a bigger question of, are colleges and universities the spaces for learning that we like to pretend and hope and sometimes achieve or have them be? Or do we need to look for other spaces? And I think, just because of what's happened to me, I'm in the position of looking for other spaces. But I will continue to do the work that I've been doing my adult life, which is, questioning power, learning everything I can. It's been really interesting this past year, because I have had the opportunity to learn very fast about a lot of different things and sort of how to continue to like put my, thoughts on record. I'm learning in real time. I'm changing my mind. People are, helping me think better and ask better questions. And, you know, sometimes that's scary and sometimes that's overwhelming, but mostly it's a gift. And I want to continue to write, and I want to continue to be in conversation with the people that help me think about the kind of world that I want to work for and that I want to live in the future. And so many of those people are Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank and in the diaspora who have been teaching me about liberation and pushing me to think more expansively and more radically. And I'm just going to continue to do that for as long as I have the opportunity to.
And I wish you the best of luck with it. And,
thank you.
You know, I look forward to catching up again. And I want to thank you for taking time, Maura Finkelstein. Thank you for coming on Real Talk and taking time out of your busy schedule. And best of luck with everything. And safe flight, too.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a real honor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Maura. Thank you.